Hello everyone. As you are no doubt aware, Eating Raoul features the very unique death by an iron skillet. Talk about deadpan humor. If you're into interesting demises, be sure and check out her book, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, available in e- or print format on Amazon. Also, we record our show in downtown Toronto, and it's construction season, so if you hear some drilling in the background, we apologize. On with the show.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
There is nearly $500 here.
These swinger types always seem to have money.
Well, now it's ours. You want his watch?
Thanks.
Do you realize that we have made almost $1,000 in 2 days, tax-free?
Just by killing people.
Horrible sex-crazed maniacs that nobody in the world would miss. I wonder how much we could make if we really put our minds to it.
What do you mean?
The city is full of rich perverts. If somehow we could get them to come to the apartment...
Okay, why would they? We'd have to lure them with...
sex.
But you wouldn't really have to. I mean, you wouldn't actually do anything.
Of course not. The minute they try anything dirty, you pop them in the head, get rid of them like you did with this guy.
Mary, how would we contact them? We don't know anything about the swinger business.
Ask someone who does.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 126, Paul Bartel's Eating Raoul. Very black comedy, very John Waters-esque, even
Indeed.
Though this is Paul Bartel watering waters in a way, and with the leggy hellhole star. We podcasted that bizarre cult hospital horror film, Hellhole, Mary Warrenoff, who was a good friend of Paul Bartel's, and they collaborated together. She was a Warhol girl.
Yep.
And very unique looking, that's for sure. And
well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, first of all, like, I mean, way back when, at the beginnings of the Really Awful Movies podcast, when we talked about some of the films that got us into low-budget cinema, and you mentioned Eating Raoul. And I too really enjoyed Eating Raoul, and you were talking about Mary Warrenoff, and you use the adjective super attenuated. And I had never heard that before, and so every time you mention Mary Warrenoff now, or any time I see her, I keep thinking that.
I'm sure she'd be glad to hear it.
Now, as I revisited this movie for recording this podcast, I was thinking, wow, you know, this really is really Waters-esque. So when you said it, I was like, damn right, it is Waters-esque. Now, Paul Bartel is an incredible figure. He's a cult actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You ask most people in the street who's Paul Bartel, they won't know. But he wrote this film, he directed this film, and of course he starred in it. He's got such a wonderful presence. I mean, the man has been in hundreds of movies. A lot of, as you said before, collaborations with Mary Warnov. They were in, for example, Rock and Roll High School together.
Yes.
Rock and Roll High School. But yeah, I mean, he's one of those guys that, like, when you see him in one of his movies, you're like, oh, this is the great Paul Bartel. But then the other day, I kind of had this hankering to watch a film, a very derided film from my childhood, that I happen to really like. And I thought to myself, you know what, I want to revisit it, because I remember watching this summer, and this gave me a good feeling. And now it's summer again, and I want to have a feeling again. The film was Caddyshack 2.
Well.
Yeah, the sequel to comedy classic Caddyshack.
Yeah.
This one starring Jackie Mason as opposed to Rodney Dangerfield. It held up for me. I loved it. Even though it was as derided in its day as, you know, again, Ghostbusters is.
Oh, my God.
This day.
What a drop-off from...
Have you seen Caddyshack 2?
No, but I can't accept Rodney Dangerfield to Jackie Mason.
Well, I really... See, I grew up with Jackie Mason, so I loved it. Jonathan Silverman was in it, that guy from Weekend at Bernie's. Chevy Chase was in it, he was the only actor to come back.
Yeah.
Dan Aykroyd was in it, and Paul Bartel had a role in it. Paul Bartel, he's a delight. And him and Mary Warnoff has such wonderful chemistry together. As you mentioned, and I've said this before in other podcasts, Mary Warnoff is an absolute treasure. She can be in the schlockiest of schlock or something that's a little more elevated. She always brings the good. She always rises above. Former Andy Warhol superstar, factory superstar, just a wonderful, wonderful presence. An actress and a presence. And when you have Warnoff and Bartel together, man, you got some magic going. And yes, you talked about black comedy. Now, if somebody asks you, what is a black comedy? What is your definition of a black comedy? Show them Eating Raoul. This is the textbook definition of a black comedy. How would you define a black comedy?
Oh, I was thinking, too, is, again, you know, my parents introduced me to Hitchcock, and I was thinking about the Shirley MacLaine vehicle called The Trouble with Harry, which is about a bunch of people, comedically, in many cases, trying to deal with a dead body and move it around and try and not get caught by the authorities. And that's the kind of thing where you have difficult circumstances which have humor injected into them.
Exactly.
And this, it couldn't be more archetypal than this thing.
Yeah.
And we've talked about City TV on the podcast before, which is a local Toronto TV station that aired Blue movies.
I will say was, because although it's still in existence, it's a shell of what it used to be.
Yeah, but during the time, it aired Baby Blue movies, softcore porno films on Friday nights after 11 o'clock. And Toronto at the time was notoriously dull, with backward drinking hours and lots of just, it was anti-fun. I think Hemingway mentioned when he lived here and wrote for the Toronto Star that there were more churches than there were bars or something to that effect. This is a city known for Presbyterian dullness, and City TV came and brought these softcore films, and I remember seeing in the TV Guide, whoa, this is really taking us back here, TV Guide, an actual print publication to find out what is on TV. Can you think of anything more antediluvian or old or ridiculous? And when I read the premise for this movie, I think it was airing at 2:30 in the morning, I said, I'm setting my alarm for this. I would have been 14, 15. I'm going to wake up at 2:30, sneak downstairs, turn on the TV and watch this thing, because this has the premise that is can't miss. This introduced me to exploitation film.
It's so funny because...
Single-handedly.
Yeah, because you're right. I mean, they played their Baby Blue movies, they also played their late grade movies, and then they would play these exploitation... That's how I discovered Phantom of the Paradise, was as a late grade movie. Brian De Palma's masterpiece, Phantom of the Paradise. It, you know, you bring up TV Guide. Well, our Canadian alternative TV Guide was Star Week. And every week in the Saturday Star, which was their, you know, their big thick weekend edition, in the middle of the paper was a magazine called Star Week, and that was their, that was the television guide. And what I would do, and of course, you know, I'm betraying my age a bit here, but of course this was pre-internet, this was, you know, the mid-1980s, I would pull out the Star Week and go through page by page, day by day, and I would highlight every single movie that
was interesting. That's uncanny.
Yeah, I did the same.
I want to say there's a horror movie called The Uncanny, but there really
isn't.
There probably is. I did the same thing, and I, as I've mentioned before, when I, even with the Italian films, I would get out my Italian-English dictionary and find out if there was a salacious title, and if it aired after midnight, and I found out something was particularly lascivious and sexual, then I would set my alarm and watch it and check out the Italian language Toronto channel and see if there was any softcore that I could watch. So this is what you had to do, kids. millennials, when you did not have the interwebs out there to be able to track down your nudity. You had to work for your nudity.
This film did have a little bit of nudity. It's not just a nudity, it's just these great, exploitation
tropes. Yeah. What to do with a body. That's the classic exploitation film noir trope.
Yeah, and
what you can do.
And that's what black comedy is. It's where you take a premise that's morbid and you inject it with humor. And I mean, John Waters was the king of black comedy, but this movie is very much in that vein, very much in that spirit. It's a hoot from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And it's Mary Warnow's a treasure, Paul Bartel's a treasure, this movie's a treasure.
And we're introduced to the film via some weird newsreel about talking about how decadent, depraved Los Angeles is, specifically Hollywood. And there's this montage.
To the rich and powerful and to the broken destitute. Debauchery permeates every aspect of society.
This is true, and it hasn't changed, really. And this is the backdrop against which this is set, because you have two really dull people on the surface with straightforward jobs. There are a couple, Paul and Mary.
Right, yeah, Paul Bartel and Mary Warnoff playing Paul and Mary bland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
doesn't get much more straightforward than that. Yeah.
And yeah, they have their everyday workday jobs, and they're a very, very chaste couple. They're disgusted by all the depravity they see around them. They sleep in two separate single beds with like a night table in the middle. I Love Lucy back in the
day.
And yeah, one of them is a nutritionist in a hospital. That would be Mary Warnoff.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one, it's hilarious.
Yeah, he works in a crappy wine store you have across the street. That's fueled several of our podcasts, actually.
They're not today.
So yeah, yeah.
We're enjoying one beer right
beer.
Now. Yeah.
He's an oenophile. I've only seen it. I don't know how it's pronounced. He's a wine connoisseur. Oenophile. Oenophile? I don't know.
Oenophile?
Who knows? He's a file of something. And he loves his wine. He recommends a Beaujolais to a customer instead of the usual shitty Planc that they sell.
Chateau Lafite.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is hilarious. And then he faces, recrimination from his boss for telling a customer that the wine that he's supposed to push is shit.
It's
and
cheap Planc, and yeah. You gotta buy the Chateau Lafite,
Lafite, and I love that. That's just killing me as a kid, yeah.
And you're good, and not only that, but then a guy comes into the store, and he pulls out a gun, and he wants to rob them, and then the owner pulls out his gun and blows the guy away,
yeah.
As if nothing happened.
Yeah.
It's just, it's that sort of movie.
Wacky, yeah.
So, Paul and Mary, Paul Bartel does not look very young. I mean, they're a young couple with a dream. And their dream is they want to open up their own restaurant. Paul and Mary's Country Kitchen.
Yeah. Oh, I just love that so much. And given that their name is Bland, their surname, they wanted their special to be the Bland Enchilada.
Are we going to still serve the Bland Enchilada?
Yeah.
Well, of course. That's going to be the speciality, And we have this, Paul Bartel, there's the thing about his persona, he's got this very, I don't want to say snobbish, but this very kind of nose in the air.
Well, he's a wine connoisseur.
He has
a PBS kind of vibe to him.
He's super square. Yeah.
You get the impression he's dead from the waist down. Mm-hmm. He's just a complete asexual.
Very proper.
Yeah.
Very
English in a way.
Yeah.
Apologies to our listeners in the UK.
Very proper. And, he's this oenophile, whatever you want to call him. He's got a collection of Chateau Lafite. He doesn't want to sell it to fund their restaurant. Because the thing is, they get this offer from this real estate agent. Was it James? Is that the name of the real estate agent?
Yeah.
He wants to sell, offers them this property that would be perfect for the restaurant, but they got to come up with a $20,000 down payment. Now, they're of limited means because
Paul has been fired from his job as a wine merchant because he's insulted the product he's supposed to pitch. So he's left stuck with no means to finance a restaurant that they want to open on simply a nurse/nutritionist salary. Yeah. So
they got to come up with money within a week.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary says, why don't you sell some of your Chateau Lafite? I'm just
picturing the grapes being stomped right now. It's just great in the smelly feet.
And he finally relents and says, okay, I'll sell 6 bottles. And he meets up with this wine connoisseur who's supposed to buy his bottles, and he ends up absconding with the bottles. No money. So they're really at the end of the rope. They don't know what to do. They got to put 20 grand in a week.
And they happen to live in accommodations that, according to Paul, is a building which, it's, I think my apartment falls into a similar category. It's a building which is attracting some real scum of late. And they're coming home from a day at work, they go to their apartment, and they see that in the hallway and on the elevator there's a bunch of perverts and a bunch of swingers who have descended upon their abode and their apartment dwelling to go to a sex romp, a sex party in their building, and if I'm not mistaken, on their very floor.
Yeah, and of course they're coming on to Paul and Mary, come join us.
Come swing with us.
And they're just disgusting. So this party's going on, and Paul and Mary, Paul's like, yeah, there's some real unsavory people coming to this building as of late.
Huh.
And then they get this unexpected visitor.
Yeah, who's trying to find the swinging sex party and happens upon their apartment erroneously.
Yes.
He comes in and he's this typical skinny 70s swinger guy with the tight disco outfit and lecherous and trying to hit on Mary.
He tries to hit on Mary and he gets a little, well, first of all, he goes into the bathroom and because he throws up on the carpet,
yeah,
and they take him in the bathroom, and they think he drowned in the toilet bowl. And then when they realize that he's still
sentient, he recovers fairly quickly, and they kick him out. And I guess he does make his way to the party, or he gets assisted to the party by Paul. Takes him to the party.
That's where he meets the dominatrix. Later on into the movie, and he's absolutely disgusted. But while Paul is being touched up against his will by the dominatrix, this guy comes back to the apartment and he gets very aggressive with Mary. And when Paul comes back, he doesn't know what to do. He has to rescue his loving wife. He grabs whatever's at hand, which is a cast iron skillet, and bonk, hits the guy over the head.
Yes, so he's done. He's met his maker.
Yep.
He's stone dead. What are they going to do with this body? They rifle through his pockets, figure out who the scum is, and
they realize he's got $600 in his wallet, and that's going to go a long way towards
financing the restaurant, paying rent, and $600 is a lot of money, and still is in 1982.
Despite, that murderer, and of course Paul insists it wasn't a murder, it was an accidental death, they try to come across the money honestly. Mary goes out to get a loan. The bank manager, played by Buck Henry, everyone's a swinger.
And
everybody's coming on to Mary.
Yeah.
And as he's basically trying to aggressively have his way with her, some of the other bank brass walk in. He claims that,
she was coming on to him in order to try and facilitate a loan. Yeah.
And so on. So again, they are sort of at their wits' end. So they come up with this plan that in order to get this money, they're going to lure swingers to their apartment, depraved degenerates.
Yeah, because people who no one would miss.
Right.
They're just a bunch of sex crazed perverts. So
conk them over the head of the frying pan and steal whatever's in their wallet. Now, in order to do so, they have to consult with the dominatrix that Paul met earlier, and that's hilarious when they meet the dominatrix at home.
Oh, yeah. The dominatrix has a pretty quotidian, pretty basic home life.
Mm-hmm.
She's a suburban mom with a kid who's crying, and she's just living a normal suburban existence. But in her nightlife, she tells men to lick her boot scum, and she has a whip, and she basically tells the Blands how to navigate the swinging scene. She asks at one point, have you taken any acting classes? And Mary says, oh, in high school. And she says, perfect, that's all you need. And basically it shows her how to treat people like dirt and put on a performance, because a lot of these men need a mother figure, and this is how they're going to do it. So they set up an ad that they run in the Hollywood Reporter, which has got to be some in-joke against the movie industry, right? And they figure, who knows what, they put in this ad, they have a picture of themselves dressed up as swingers.
I got it right here. They advertise themselves as Naughty Nancy and Cruel Carla.
Okay.
And
then within a day, they've got a pile of mail on their living room table. they decide to see who their prospective clients are and start to run this scheme of killing people. And of course, this movie throughout has a bunch of people with weird sexual proclivities
Everybody
of all stripes.
you got your infantilism fantasies, you got your Nazi fantasies.
Yes,
you got
and then a terrific cameo by Ed Begley Jr. from This Is Spinal Tap and mm-hmm. a slew of other movies, Seen Elsewhere, where he plays this hippy-dippy, loopy 70s tie stick, Grateful Dead listening wavy gravy type guy who comes in and they set up, you know, the Blands invest a lot of preparation in their stuff. So when they get the pervert to come to their house, they put on Grateful Dead music, they put on the, you know, they dress the part of a 70s hippie, late 60s hippie, and when he comes in, they, you know, kill him, take his money, and again, they have all an assortment of weirdos who come in, Nazis, and who play the German national anthem, all these fringe society people that, again, nobody misses, they steal their money.
And I just started laughing because I just got a vision of Paul, because while Mary's, you know, doing her dominatrix routine, Paul is dressed, ready to come in for the kill, in like a black cat burglar outfit with like a Lone Ranger mask. Yes. It's his identity.
And that's where a lot of the comedy comes in. He is wielding a skillet, a frying pan, and he's just lurking in the kitchen behind the swinging door, ready to pounce when she gives the word. And generally, these guys cannot keep their hands to themselves for a second, and they start pulling her clothes apart right away, and he just comes in, dunk, and then they just fall down. And this is great because, again, this is wonderful black comedy, but its title is derived from something.
Right.
Who is this Raul?
Who is this Raul? Yes.
And Raul is a Latino, suave character from the neighborhood.
He's a locksmith.
Yes.
And they originally, because somebody... Was it something broke in or something had the key to their abode? And
I think they just figured with their lifestyle of what they're doing, they would probably just want to, you know, I forget how this came about.
Because in the same paper that they advertised in, he advertised that he would change locks for $12.95.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And he comes by, he wants to upsell them, oh no, this now is $20.
Yeah, inflation or whatever.
Right away,
yeah.
Paul's like, yeah, you're very, he's a shady character.
Yeah.
And he is not just a locksmith, he's a thief.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes in one night and he sees a couple of these bodies and he blackmails Paul and Mary.
Yeah.
And says, okay, you know what? We're going to go in business together. We're going to do this 50-50. And you're going to kill them, you're going to take the money, and I'm going to take the bodies.
Yeah, an interesting conceit.
Yes.
And he uses the bodies for a side business, which involves his friend / business associate who is running a, again, this is pretty dark material, he's running a dog food operation, and this is absurd. Like, how, you can get pretty low-end meat, can't you? Like, is this, who knows? Anyway,
yeah, I mean,
this is human meat to procure for
basically,
man's best friend.
You know, I'm an English teacher, right? And I don't want to talk much about the literacy level of students today, but many of them don't know what the word byproduct means. So I have to explain to them byproduct. And I say, you know, when they make your steaks and then whatever falls on the floor that they stuff into a tube and that becomes your hot dog, then that's the byproduct. And then I say whatever is not even deemed fit for the hot dog then becomes your dog food, and I call it the tri-product. I mean, even that's maybe a word that I coined, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you can make dog food out of the tri-product, but you know what, in this world, they're using humans. Maybe the dogs like it better.
Hot dogs. Sweet, sweet hot dogs. I'm getting hungry now thinking about
I don't
care what's in them.
Yeah. So now they're involved in a shady character, this Raul guy. Him and Raul and Mary actually start getting, you know, a little romantically involved.
Yeah, I guess because one of the clients, when Paul is out running an errand, I forget, maybe he's picking up dinner or something.
Yeah,
one of the clients...
Maybe he's thinking of a dildo. That was another great scene.
One of the clients comes on to Mary, and he's not around to kill them stone dead with his frying pan. And then, as a result, Raul becomes her savior, kills the perv. And that's a great alliteration. And he becomes sexually involved with her.
Yeah.
And also follows her to her place of work, which is the hospital, and they get it on in the examination room in her in the infirmary, in the hospital there, while she's supposed to be making the rounds with other patients. So a really neat tension between, yeah, with this plot that they're orchestrating here from the back pages of this seedy magazine, and also the stooping of Paul's wife behind his back. And he suspects it as well, because why wouldn't you? You sleep in separate beds. It's not like he wouldn't assume she would seek out pleasure elsewhere. But a hilarious thing. And he's such a great character, too. Like, I forget his name. Is it Robert Beltran?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah. And he's just a suave, hilarious character, and you just can't help but root for him. He's fantastic.
Well, I was not really rooting for Raoul. I didn't like him.
Okay.
But that's okay. I was rooting for Paul.
The cuckold. The poor cuckold.
Husband. But, yeah, I mean, ultimately, these two, they're involved in this sort of triangle, Paul, Mary, Raoul, and they want the amount of money because another couple expressed interest in this property. It then gets raised to, I believe, $30,000. They got to come up with the money really fast.
Bidding war, and they also realize that Raoul, on the side, is sneaking into the parking lots and procuring the keys of the victims and selling off their cars for scrap. Mm-hmm. And so they're thinking he's two-timing them because he's getting all these huge proceeds from the sale of cars from these perverts, and all they're doing is bagging the money from that they happen to bring with them in their wallets.
He's getting money from the cars, he's getting money from the bodies.
Yes, he's got a good scheme going.
Yeah. So ultimately they've got to step up their killing, they got to raise more money, and there's also the problem of Raoul. And the title of the movie basically spoils the ending.
Yeah, it's true.
But at the same time, perhaps we should maybe not say, mm-hmm. you know, the fate that actually befalls Raoul, but
yeah.
it's totally
hilarious as the henpecked husband starts to get wind of something happening and it's pretty obvious in a social situation when people have a certain sexual chemistry. He sees that there's something amiss there, and he starts to tail Raoul, following him around to his job, and he actually pays, I believe, the dominatrix to go undercover, which is common for her. She adopts several roles as a lady of the evening, although she doesn't prostitute herself, per se.
She goes undercover as a blind nun.
As a blind nun,
as an immigration officer, a health inspector.
Yeah.
Kind of the guy who's got some sort of venereal disease.
Yeah, basically trying to chase Raoul away.
Yeah.
And just great stuff.
Yeah. Well, let's just say that eventually the problem of Raoul does get solved, and Paul and Mary Bland do live happily ever after.
Yeah, and they're able to finance their Gordon Ramsay approved boutique bed and breakfast restaurant, wherever it is.
And serve the bland enchilada for all the punters. So this movie is a delight. It's hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
It's dark, you know.
And every man, when we mean this, every man is a complete lecher, just lusting after Mary in every single capacity. There's a pretty funny scene earlier on where there's a guy in hospital that Mary is tending to, and she pawns off the administering of an enema to this guy because he's so over the top hitting on her, and she just can't take it anymore.
It reminds me a bit of Larry from Three's Company.
Actually. Yes, a little bit. And every single man, between the patient who's just hitting on this leggy woman and the banker who is just completely smitten with her, to
Raoul, of course.
Raoul, everyone they meet is just completely taken with her. And it's just a great role because you could see it. She's got legs from here till Wednesday.
Yeah.
She's just, you know, something unique to behold. And the pairing of those two with the outwardly square, rotund, balding, bearded, you know, sad sack husband and the sexpot wife. It's just a great dynamic. It's a fun movie.
Fun movie.
Really so much just hilarious.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn from Ian Raoul?
Oh, I learned that there's some great lines because, again, we get exposed to the seedy underbelly of West Hollywood, and they attract all these people, and when they get the Nazi in, they beat him over the head, bag him, send him out for dog food. One of the lines is, "I'll bag the Nazi and straighten up here," which is like, you will never hear that in any other movie. It's like, I was just dying. It's just great. And the tone of this thing is just so off the charts. Like, it's just really wrong in every respect.
Uh-huh.
And I can't imagine this being, again, released today for any kind of audience other than the Fringe. This is full-on exploitation, sexpot comedy of the type that they usually made in the 60s. So it was weird seeing this in 1982. It had a really different, like, it was seemed not of its time, but it was also a send-up of 1950s culture. I mean, the Blands have a bunch of 50s furniture, mm-hmm. So it really is a satire on the perfect marriage.
That's right. Mary even had a collection of 50s furniture.
Yes.
Yeah, indeed. What I learned, this is interesting, because I was doing some research, you know, as I always do before we podcast a movie. I like to look for facts and tidbits and whatnot, and I found a very interesting fact about the making of this movie. That is, that advertisement, when they were advertising their dominatrix services, you know, Naughty Nancy and... This was a very low-budget movie. Extremely low-budget. And to the point that they would actually buy short ends of film to put together and film this thing, and they couldn't afford to actually get a legitimate mock-up of an ad. So they found that it would be cheaper to print a real ad. And where did they print that real ad? LA Weekly.
Interesting.
Which was, LA Weekly.
LA Weekly.
That gave, you know, gave some very nice coverage for a book.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 81, they actually placed a real ad for their dominatrix services in LA Weekly.
Amazing.
Shot it for the film, and unlike in the movie where they got a flood of responses, their ad garnered one single response.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's a really unique little tidbit, which I was glad to learn.
Wow, and at this point, maybe, though I don't know if you would divulge it, do I dare ask, have you ever solicited the services of the back pages of some alternative weekly magazine?
Okay, well...
we'll let listeners suss that one out for themselves, or...
we love those back pages growing up. I mean, that was something where... Very,
again, pre-internet. This was exactly. In Toronto. You have Now Magazine, which got the bulk of its business, despite being a progressive, left-wing, feminist magazine, got all much of their, and still do, get much of their revenue from certain services being rendered in the back pages, whether that be massages, or other...
Company.
A company, yes.
For the evening.
Yeah. So it's interesting when, again, you're coming of age sexually and you're exploring new worlds of cinema and new worlds of sexuality in through media. And mm-hmm. It just goes to show how hard we had it as Generation Xers versus now, where you just type in anything and something comes up and you could see it. So you had to really work for it and you had to really discover things.
But yet, you know what? I loved it. Like, I mean, in retrospect, I don't want to sound like a grumpy old man, but there was something just so wonderful about those days. Now, you asked me the question, but now... I'm just playing with this completely.
Yeah, I'm going to do so likewise.
Okay.
Star rating.
Oh, I give it 4 stars for this one.
Yeah, it is hilarious. John Waters, dark comedy. Anytime you have to move a body, I think that's just ripe for hilarity. It's just such a circumstance that's so filled with tension and weirdness, mm-hmm. and it's just a great way to go.
And the other thing that's very interesting about Ian Rule as well is that there's a lot of taboos that are broken, especially the ending,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, the film still retains this weird sort of tone of wholesomeness.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of it has to do with Paul and Mary sort of like 50s, you know, like uber, you know, nuclear
chaste,
family.
Chaste, dull marriage.
Yeah, I don't know. It's such a unique piece of cinema. And, you know, we lost Paul Bartel a little too soon, and mm-hmm. Unfortunately, and he was just a tremendous talent. And I urge our listeners, if they haven't seen Eating Raoul, please, you owe it to yourself to seek it out.
Another thing I learned, because I always forget about these things, but... there's a Spanish language version of Devil with a Blue Dress On, and this was an excellent soundtrack. Devil with a blue dress, blue dress, devil with a blue dress on. Dun, 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 dun. And this was hilariously rendered in Spanish
by Los Lobos.
Los Lobos.
Yeah.
An amazing band I saw open for Neil Young, and great that they're still kicking.
Probably most famous for doing the soundtrack to La Bamba.
Yes.
You know,
Ricky
Valens biopic starring Lou Diamond Phillips, and this is their sort of like North American debut, singing there.
Really cool.
Indeed.
Lots of stuff to commend this, a 4-star likewise as well, and check out our 4-star website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com, with a bunch of our favorite genre films from the 60s to today reviewed, and also our podcast. And if you have any feedback for any film we should cover, any exploitation, horror, what have you, shoot us an email, reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thank you.